Today's episode of Hidden Forces is made possible by listeners like you. For more information about this week's episode or for easy access to related programming, visit our website at hiddenforces.io and subscribe to our free email list. If you listen to the show on your Apple Podcast app, remember, you can give us a review. Each review helps more people find the show and join our amazing community. And with that, please enjoy this week's episode. What's up, everybody? My guest today is Professor Steve Keen. Steve is a distinguished research fellow at University College London and one of the few economists to correctly and publicly anticipate the global financial crisis of 2008, as well as the subsequent deflationary forces that would frustrate and confound policymakers in the years afterwards. He is also the author of Debunking Economics, The Naked Emperor Dethroned, as well as his more recent book titled Can We Avoid Another Financial Crisis? Steve and I have known each other going back almost 10 years now. He was a frequent guest on my old television program Capital Account, and over those years, he really helped me gain a more complete picture of the monetary system and how money is actually created, which I think is so counterintuitive that I think for most people, it takes some time for it to really sink in. And I think if you want to challenge your understanding, especially if you're wedded to an Austrian theory of money and credit, as I was for so many years, Dr. Keen's work can really help to stimulate your curiosity because it draws from so many different perspectives. And also because Steve is a gadfly of sorts in the economics community. He likes to find these areas where he feels that thinking has stagnated or become conventional or where the consensus has gotten it wrong and go in there and stir things up. And we stir things up today for sure, but it's also a jovial conversation because, again, we've known each other for so long, and also because I only found out Steve would be in town a few days before this recording, and so I didn't have time to create a rundown. So this conversation is not structured in the way that most of my conversations are, but it is no less engaging and interesting because Steve has been spending more and more of his time lately on the economics of climate change, which is something we haven't really talked about on this show. It's something we spent a lot of time on today, including a host of other topics, many of which we get into in the overtime, which goes on for an additional 40 minutes or so. Also, for anyone interested, Steve has a Patreon page where he posts a ton of educational material, including podcasts, video blogs, ebooks, you name it. So make sure to check that out. It's at patreon.com/ProfSteveKeen. So, without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Professor Steve Keen. Dr. Steve Keen, welcome to Hidden Forces.
Good to be here, Matt. Good to be with you in a different venue to a previous life as interviewer and interviewee.
For sure. Well, I wasn't the interviewer in the previous life.
You might as well have been.
I drove the agenda.
You did drive the agenda.
Yeah. Oh my God, and what an agenda it was. We were just talking about that outside in the green room. There was definitely an agenda. Every morning with Capital Account, we would have show meetings. Everything had to fit within a particular angle. How does this reinforce the fact that central banks are bad, governments are bad, the markets are good, you know? And you get boxed into it. It wasn't like something that I came up with disingenuously. I got boxed into an ideology that no longer really fit.
Yeah, yeah. It gives you a formula, but a formula that can lead you astray as well as give you a structure.
Yeah, it's kind of one of the problems with a lot of the way that media is done today. It doesn't offer the opportunity to grow because growing means breaking with your stated beliefs and those beliefs also are what the audience has come to expect.
Mm.
They're coming to you for validation that their views of the world are correct. And if you give them something else, they feel betrayed.
Sometimes. I mean, it's most media is like that these days, and it makes it very frustrating to work with it.
Mm. I had that happen with, and it shouldn't have happened because I don't know, you know, I'm not really sure what sort of the general audience listener of this show thinks, but I did an episode with Andrew Marantz, who is a lefty.
Yeah,
he's a staff writer for the New Yorker. You know what I mean?
That makes him a lefty. Okay.
Well, New Yorker is a lefty magazine in New York. And he grew up in Park Slope, Brooklyn, you know, and he wrote a book on online troll culture, you know, Milo Yiannopoulos, those guys.
Yeah.
And he like embedded with them for a while. And whatever, like we've done episodes that I've been very critical of cancel culture and political correctness and stuff. So this is the one episode where, you know, I covered the obscene, you know, kind of right-wing-ish, trollish people. And I got a couple of emails from like, you know, people who felt like I was shilling for the deep state. That was one of the subjects of the email. Deep state shill. Hidden Voices is now a deep state shill. So I don't know. What are you going to do? It's a few extreme voices that get amplified. And you must have to deal with that too, though.
All the time. I mean, you can imagine what the conventional economists think of me. So I cop crap for them, and I have for the last literally 50 years. Just shy of 50 years. It'll be 50 years
don't
of copying.
Say 50.
50 years of copying shit from neoclassical economists will be in 2021. So I'm not too far away from it. So that gave me a fairly thick skin for somebody who's inherently fairly sensitive, having to cope with being rubbished and ridiculed all the time. And then, of course, I take on the Austrian perspective, even though I've got sympathies with some parts of Austrian thinking, so I cop it from there. My first target in terms of academic writing was Marxists, because I could not accept the labor theory of value.
When you were still studying?
When I was still studying.
I was undergrad or graduate
student? Undergrad.
You went to the University of Sydney?
Yep, which was a fabulous place to go in the period I went. It's still a pretty good university, but when I was there, it was right in the middle of the Vietnam War, so we were stupid enough to join America in invading Vietnam.
Did you have long hair back then?
Yeah, I did. In fact, it was actually an afro.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I feel like I've actually seen that picture.
I remember once
Bell-bottoms, jeans.
Bell-bottoms, yes, I could admit to those.
Leather jacket?
Never a leather jacket, but I had some pretty amazing crocheted tops and stuff like that. But I remember one time, my hair was so curly once, I just looked in the mirror and just made a little mental note of what it looked like, and my girlfriend remarked on how curly it was, and I said, it looks like I combed my hair with an Alka-Seltzer.
Alka-Seltzer.
She broke up. But yeah, that's how hair, and of course now I'm down the usual story, gray, short haired, and if it goes along, it looks scraggly, so I'm off to get a cut after this interview, I think.
That's so interesting. We should actually get into the whole boomer thing on Bitcoin. We were talking about that earlier. But you mentioned Austrian economics. This is something else we were talking about before we started. When I had Capital Account, well, before the financial crisis, to back up, the way that I undid a lot of the misperceptions that I had developed during the course of my undergraduate degree in economics was to chance upon Austrian economic theory, particularly the theory of the business cycle. And I was reading those guys, and those guys helped me see the crisis. And then when the crisis came, I doubled down on Austrian economic theory, and I kind of became very ideological. And I've spent the last however many years, maybe 7 years, really since 2012, since it became clear that the Austrian models that I was using to interpret the economy were not explaining what I was seeing.
Yeah, well, they were certainly okay, but getting the approach of a crisis and the aftermath of the crisis, they got completely wrong, because they basically accepted, because of the government response, they expected hyperinflation. I don't know how many of them are aware of this, but they're based on the model that banks lend out reserves, this money multiplier model.
Yeah.
And then you have this enormous increase in reserves by Bernanke. I think he literally added about $2 trillion to the reserve accounts of banks in less than a year. It was a ridiculous increase in the reserves. And then if you believe that model, then there was going to be an enormous surge of inflation. And the more pragmatic approach to economics that I come from, which is the post-Keynesian school, I'm influenced by the post-Keynesians. Call myself a complexity theorist when I actually want to put a serious tag on myself. But they looked at the mechanics of banking, and this was actually understood before the Great Depression as well by people like Schumpeter, some mainstream economists. Banks create money by lending, but they cannot lend out reserves. There's one condition under which they can lend reserves, and that is all loans are in cash. Now, if you walk into a bank and they lend you $1 million and you have to walk out with a wheelbarrow, then maybe the idea that lend reserves makes sense. But they don't do that. They give you a an increase in your deposit account. And that means they simply, in terms of accounting, cannot lend the reserves out. So from our point of view, so that's not going to do anything.
Well, they create the reserves.
Well, the lending, it actually works in reverse in some ways. Lending, the loan creates a deposit. So you go to the bank, they say, yep, buying that flat in Manhattan is a great idea. Here's $2 million. And by the way, you owe us $2 million. So their assets and your liabilities rise by $2 million. Their liabilities and your assets rise by $2 million. You then spend that $2 million buying the property off somebody else, so you create demand doing it as well. But the reserves themselves play no role in that unless you bank at a different bank than the person you bought the property off. And then the reserves act like deposit accounts for private banks that there is at the central bank. That's their main role. So they circulate in a completely independent system.
Is the reserve ratio an anachronism or a legacy of the gold standard?
To some extent, but it's become a legacy because of textbook misinterpretations of what the reserve ratio is actually there for. There's a brilliant paper by a guy called O'Brien. I think he was a reserve staff when he wrote it, talking about reserve ratios in OECD countries. He goes through each of them. And the reserve ratio in America is 10%. Take a look at the fine print. It's 10% on banks above a certain level of deposits. I think it's about $30 million, so it's quite a small level. But it's 10% of household deposits. For corporate deposits, it's zero. Mm. For overseas commercial holdings, it's zero. It's there in case the households panic, go to the bank and want to take money out. If 10% of your customers turn up in one day to withdraw the money, it's a bad day. But if you have 10% cash on hand, you can catch them, and then the reserve will rush the cash to you before the next banking day starts and you won't run out of money. So it's there in case there's a panic by the household sector, fundamentally. Mm. When you look at the actual proportion of the cash flow of America, which is actually affected by those reserve ratios, it's less than 2% of the money supply. There are some good Federal Reserve papers. O'Brien's one, another by Carpenter and Demelrapp, I think it is, do the same thing. And they go and say, looking at the practicalities, it doesn't really exist as a ratio. But it's still part of the mindset people have about how they interpret banking.
You and I got into a conversation about this on Twitter not long ago.
Okay.
There was someone else on that thread.
Mm.
I can't remember who it was, someone from the Bitcoin community. And they were talking about reserve ratios, et cetera. You remember this conversation? And then Michael Kumhoff's name came up.
Yeah, Michael's a good friend.
Right. We had dinner with Michael in 2012. Remember that?
It was a great
It was the sushi restaurant.
And it was with a guy from the old American Monetary Institute, from Stephen Zalenga.
Maybe.
I think it was Stephen Zalenga.
Because we had dinner another time with another guy who was a hedge fund manager here in New York.
Yeah.
You was always bringing these interesting characters with you on your trips to DC, or people would end up meeting. It was a fun time doing that. So what are you working on these days?
Well, I'm still working on the monetary stuff. I've actually built a software package called Minsky for mathematical modeling of financial dynamics and general dynamics as well. So that's the monetary stuff is still alive and well. But one thing which has always troubled me about economics, and not just neoclassical economics here, but Austrian, Marxian, post-Keynesian, none of them have acknowledged the role of energy in production.
Mm.
So they all pretend you can produce output by combining labor and capital. And this always felt unsatisfactory to me. And I've seen various attempts to try to bring energy in to the theory of production. And what they're fundamentally, they say, well, you've got labor and you've got capital and you've got energy. And they'll then say, you know, there are three factors of production. And I looked at that and thought, well, two things are wrong with that. First of all, if you use the neoclassical model, which is called the Cobb-Douglas production function, after the two people who dreamt it up in the 1920s or 30s, I think, it has labor raised to one power, capital to another power, and then if you have energy, one minus the other two powers. So it gives you what they call constant returns to scale. I'll show you the maths later. But when you do that, if you set the coefficients at the inverted commas right level, you can say you have output with no energy input, still using it that way, which just felt, it was never satisfied with that. Even people who did a more advanced model would still go through that stage.
Did they set up any kind of constants to deal with that? How did they deal with that?
Well, they just assumed they could leave it out. And I thought that is not adequate. So I was working with a guy who was the leading physicist involved in economics trying to bring energy in, a guy called Bob Ayers. And Bob's house was full of statues, as it happens. And just walking back from the bathroom one night, this little insight popped into my brain, which was labor without energy is a corpse. Capital without energy is a sculpture. And I thought, holy shit, that's the solution. Energy is an input to labor and capital. Mathematically speaking, you put energy as an argument into your labor, energy into argument to capital. And that gives it the role that says if you don't have energy input, you can't get output either. It makes it absolutely fundamental. So I worked that out in about 2016. I've been working in that since. And of course, that's dragged me into climate change. And in looking at it...
So you started researching climate change in 2016?
Probably actually last year, 2018. Because I was, you know, had to write up these papers and I was still working on the monetary work. And so I decided, of course, in 2018, Nordhaus gets the Nobel Prize for economics. And my initial reaction...
What's his specialty in economics?
Climate change.
Oh, really?
The economics of climate change. And so my initial reaction was, well, at least they've given it... I mean, I'm a huge critic of the Nobel Prize. I think it should be abolished. The Economics Nobel Prize. You do know that it is not a Nobel Prize?
You know what? So I know a little bit about this
okay.
because we had Brian, I can't remember his last name now. He was in competition to win the Nobel Prize in physics. This was an episode.
That's a real Nobel Prize.
The real Nobel Prize. Yeah, and yeah. I learned as a result, a lot of the dirty politics that have to do with the Nobel Prize.
Well, there's politics in all elements of the
right.
prize, no doubt about that.
But what do you mean it's not the economics prize? Is not
well, the
Nobel
actual
prize.
Title of the prize is, I can't pronounce it properly because it's the Swedish Central Bank. The Sveriges Bank Award in Economics in honor of Alfred Nobel. That's its proper title. It was invented in 1969. This is all the literature.
So does the Nobel Committee have any view on this?
Well, because they got 1.4 million kroner or whatever it was, $1.4 million effectively from the central bank to pay for the prize each year.
They license it.
They effectively licensed it.
They licensed the name. They're like Trump. They're like
and,
Trump Hotel.
And they like the whole thing. The Nobel Prize family has been up in arms about it because apparently Nobel himself, Alfred Nobel.
He was the inventor of gunpowder, wasn't
this
he?
This is one funny story about, and I'm not sure this is true. I've got to read more thoroughly on this point. But what I have been told is that Nobel read his own obituary.
I think that is true.
Okay. In,
this is coming back to me.
He was in Russia, yeah. I think it was, and his brother died. And the newspapers mistook his brother for him and published the, of course, all newspapers.
Yes, it's correct. This is correct.
Role
read
with
this
the,
also.
Yeah. And there it is saying, the slaughtered so many people, greatest mass killer in history. And he apparently looked and thought, that's how I'm going to be remembered? No,
yeah.
Thank you. So he invents the prize. So his name is now associated with something positive. And that's, of course, how we think about him these days. But he had the prize in chemistry, in physics, in medicine, I think in literature and peace. Okay, there were five actual...
The peace one is the biggest bullshit. Kissinger got that in like 74,
and Obama
he?
Gets it as well. It's
yeah.
going to be... It's
but
ridiculous.
The Kissinger one is like the worst.
Yeah, I
like,
know, absolutely.
The moment Henry Kissinger got it, it completely delegitimized the
well,
Nobel
this,
Peace
this
Prize.
Was, you see, the Nobel Prize for Economics was never legitimate. It starts with people like Milton Friedman being awarded it, you know... My opinion of Friedman is unprintable.
Also, Krugman got it.
Ditto, unprintable. Oh, we can print a few things on that front. But I had no respect for the prize itself. But the prize was invented by the Swedish Central Bank, and there's a very good book called The Nobel Factor, which explains the history of it. And it was at a time when the central bank in Sweden was effectively at war with a progressive political leadership of the country, and they were championing a neoliberal, what we now call neoliberal economics approach, by instituting the prize. And it's been highly successful. So I've always been skeptical of it, critical of it, thinking it should be shut down. When Nordhaus got it, my first reaction, well, at least they gave it for climate change. And then I thought, hang on a second. I was one of the first people to read The Limits to Growth. Okay, I read
Danilo
it back,
Meadows.
In 1972. It's my most thumbed book. It was badly bound. It's fallen apart like crazy. But I bought a copy in 72 and read it back then. And I was, as somebody with a mathematical training at the time, I really appreciated what they were doing with the technology of system dynamics. So I liked it. Nordhaus destroyed it. Nordhaus destroyed its credibility with a set of papers, one of which was called Measurement Without Data, disparaging it completely and played a major role in driving this approach out of economics. And in subsequent years, I've met one of the three authors, and Randers. In fact, I met him again about 2 weeks ago in Norway. And Randers told me when I first met him, this is back in Sydney in about 2009, I think, that when they developed The Limits to Growth, they thought economists would be really happy about the idea because it was a technology that meant you didn't have to assume equilibrium anymore. Because what was actually lying behind Limits to Growth is what called system dynamics engineering. And that fundamentally says that every... Effectively, the old story, everything is connected to everything else. but you then put the feedback effects between those various things, and you can both model a system out of equilibrium, and you can also try to get the magnitudes right so you don't get the case that, you know, you've got to ignore everything. Rather than ceteris paribus, you have the major feedbacks tied together.
But they've only been able to begin to model these systems recently, right? They weren't able to use these models to model them because of the computational overload.
Well, this limits of growth was the first major computational model, and it was done between 1968 and 1971.
Right, because they
had mainframe computers back in those days. It cost, you know, back in those days, the actual cost was well over $1 million to build the model and run it. It took weeks in what was then a supercomputer to get the runs out. These days, you can run, there's actually a program on the web called InsightMaker. And InsightMaker, somebody has used InsightMaker to build the limits to growth as an InsightMaker model. You can run it on, you run it on a PC, it runs on a cloud as well, and it, you know, takes a matter of seconds to run the model. Back then, it took weeks for any of the particular runs to be done. It was a giant supercomputer in those days doing the work, so it was very difficult. But we could have been doing this approach to modeling the economy from the early 1970s. Now, instead, not only do they reject the limits to growth, they specifically being Nordhaus, who led the charge by economists against the limits to growth, they also rejected the whole technology. So rather than learning how to model systems out of equilibrium, with interacting systems and feedbacks often being more important than direct effects, they got even more obsessed with the approach of equilibrium thinking. And so the divergence of economics from understanding the real world, which the real world is a complex system which is normally far from equilibrium. That's the methodology we need to get to.
Wouldn't they argue that they try to approximate that complexity by thinking about it in terms of dynamic equilibria?
Well, yeah, but there's no such thing.
And you're still stuck in a paradigm of equilibrium.
Yeah, I mean, like when I first arrived at university, as going to do my master's degree as a prelude to doing my PhD, which was about 10 or 15 years after I finished my undergraduate degree, one of the colleagues I had at the University of New South Wales, you don't think I mentioned, mind me mentioning a guy called Peter Chrysler, he's still there today. Peter would talk about how, from his post-Keynesian point of view, economics can talk about the equilibrium, but what about the traverse? And I looked at him and sort of shook my head. What do you mean traverse? He said, well, the movement from one equilibrium to another. And coming from a dynamics background, I said, well, you don't actually start in equilibrium. You don't end there either.
Yeah.
You move, your equilibria are reference points for an overall system. But virtually every interesting system is being driven by some external force. Like, for example, you and I are driven by the sun. Mm-hmm. Okay. If it wasn't shining most of the time, then, you know, life wouldn't exist, let alone the conversations we're having. And so there's a force that gives you a pressure that means the system is driven away from its equilibrium. And the things like the way we model the weather these days, that was the weather system in terms of the ultimate nonlinearity of weather and the fact that it's out of equilibrium. That was first brought into meteorology by a guy called Lorenz in 1963. Mm-hmm. And
so, Edward Lorenz.
Yeah, yeah. And Lorenz,
he was a climatologist.
Climatologist, a mathematical climatologist. And he was critical of all the models of the weather that existed at the time, which would do things like pattern matching. So they'd say like 7 days in a row, like this had happened 32 years ago. So we're going to predict whether tomorrow is going to be like it was then the eighth day 32 years ago. Or they do linear regressions. And he said, look, we know the major forces are nonlinear. And he took what's called the Navier-Stokes equations, which are equations that describe fluid dynamics. Incredibly complicated, what are called partial differential equations. I think there's about 11 components, so there's what are called 11-dimensional model. He reduced it using mathematical procedures to a set of what are called ordinary differential equations. So only time rather than space and time is the causal for driving variables, with just three variables and three constants for those three variables. Incredibly simple model, which generated incredibly what you first of all called chaotic, we now call complex systems.
Very dense data set.
Dense, but it doesn't occupy the entire what's called phase space. So if you drew a container saying, where could you be in this space? And you put the Lorenz model inside it, there'd be parts of it would never occupy. And three parts that it would never occupy are the equilibria. They're all unstable, all three of them. Mm-hmm. But the system remains inside the bounding box defined by the overall system, but nowhere near the equilibria. It's actually repelled from the equilibria. So this is common knowledge in genuine sciences. But economics is stuck with this obsession that everything's in equilibrium. Or you talk about a movement from one equilibrium to another, which is what you mean by dynamic equilibrium.
These neoclassical models came out of the late 19th century? Was that when Walras was writing?
Neoclassical economics has changed more than neoclassical economists realize. They're actually ignorant of their own history. So if you go back and see who were the progenitors of neoclassical economics, you go back to Corno, who was a mathematician writing in the early 1800s in France. It's interesting, both French, and Jean-Baptiste Say. And Say was a foil for Ricardo. And Ricardo was somebody who came from the classical school of economics. We can have a chat about Ricardo, who's actually a con man too, by the way.
Who? Ricardo?
Ricardo was a con man, yeah. I've written a cartoon book. I should have bought a cartoon book for you. I'll send you an electronic copy. But anyway, Ricardo followed what's called the classical school of economics. And the classical school—
Ricardo gave us comparative advantage.
Yeah, and other pieces of garbage as well. But the main thing he gave us was—
Well, there is some truth to that theory, right? None at all?
No.
So for our listeners, why don't you put forward what the theory of comparative advantage is and why it doesn't work in your view? I'm not saying all the extrapolations of it, but the basic idea that you could be better in two things than I am in those two things, but it could be to my comparative advantage to do one of them and allow you to do the other.
Yeah. I mean, we use
in our little microeconomy.
And in our micro worlds, that sort of stuff makes sense. I mean, I am, for example, a lousy housekeeper. Okay, my partner is a brilliant housekeeper. She actually drives me away from the housekeeping. How convenient. Yeah, I'm really sorry about that. I mean, we can easily extrapolate that individual experience to a economy level, which is where comparative advantage is applied. Now, if you look at Ricardo, you can see what he was trying to do. And that is, he had a fundamental belief that capitalism would grow faster and last in its growth phase longer if he could get money away from the landlords and get it to the capitalists. That was his real intention. He actually says that at one stage. It's been my objective to show that wages cannot rise without a fall in profits and vice versa, so that the way to get more growth is to get more money to profits. Workers get a subsistence wage. Therefore, the way to increase the gap is to reduce the cost of subsistence, which you do by abolishing the corn laws and bringing in corn more cheaply, meaning wheat, as it happens. Mm-hmm. But that was the logic. But in the theory of comparative advantage, what he did was a brilliant piece of debating. He said, I'm going to accept the case made by my opponents, the mercantilists, who said that, look, we believe, in those days, Portugal was the major rival that the UK faced. Portugal is better at producing everything than we are. So if we have free trade, Portugal will wipe out all our industries. And what Ricardo said, I'm going to take your belief that Portugal's better at everything than us and show you that it's still in our advantage to have trade. So it's a very clever and it's a con man argument. Okay.
So he was writing in the late 18th century?
No, the early 18th.
Early 19th.
1812, 1817. That sort of period,
early 19th century.
Yeah, late 1700s, early 1800s.
Yeah, yeah.
The reason I said he's a con man is that I remember a friend of mine, we used to do a thing called Planet Wall Street back in Australia, told me a story about the Battle of Waterloo. Who's one of the ultimate evil people in capitalism? The Rothschilds or that sort of
the
person.
The Rothschilds.
One of those. He told me he had a runner at the Battle of Waterloo to see who won.
I've heard
and
the
as
story.
Soon as the battle was over, the rider just rode as fast as he could, boat was ready, all the stuff, to get to the London Stock Exchange. And Rothschild, this is what my friend tells me, he walks out onto the floor of the London Stock Exchange and goes, sell!
I wish that our listeners could see your dramatic performance right now.
And there's absolute panic on the pandemonium. Everybody thinks, oh my God, we must have lost the Battle of Waterloo. Massive sale. And then he says, buy. It wasn't. I've still got to check this fully, but it wasn't a Rothschild. It was David Ricardo. And he made a profit at the time, estimated at over
How do we know this is true? This could be fake news.
I've got to check it out because I've only seen it.
We're spreading rumors. We're defaming this man.
Well, anyway, I'll do more research.
200 years since his death.
Because I went looking for it because I wrote a cartoon book on this topic, you see. What part of a cartoon was an introduction to how bad economics was called Econ Comics.
I think I read that.
Did you?
They used to do Superman pictures of you.
That's right. That's
the guy that used to do it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So anyway, I wanted to write this thing about not David Ricardo, but David Tricardo.
Oh,
okay.
Har.
Which is what I did. And I knew about this story, and I went back and looked about when did Ricardo write and so on, because I wanted to see the publication date of The Principles of Political Economy. And I wanted it to be an April Fool's joke gone bad. And it turned out it was published on, the 17th of April. So it actually published in the month I wanted. Then I found Ricardo was the one who pulled this stunt about the Battle of Waterloo, made a million, literally, in those days, and had to leave the country and go and live in sort of rural exile before he finally bought himself a seat in Parliament and came back and lobbied for the Corn Laws. So that's the guy we're talking about. No doubt a great intellect, but a con man.
Financial history is full of these really great stories because they're so personal, you know? And they're people under immense stress. We did this episode with Daniel Paris on the history of financial theory, where we covered this in part. But to bring it back to the conversation about climate change, I haven't read Limits to Growth, but I have read Thinking in Systems by Donella Meadows. It was a fantastic book. Mm. I would recommend it to anyone who's interested in learning about systems theory and nonlinear dynamics. Mm. I also read James Gleick's book, Chaos.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Where he talked about Lorenz and lots of other people, Mandelbrot. Mm. And you've written about the physiocrats, which deals with this thing about bringing energy into the equation. But let's go back to, you said 2018, about a year or two ago. So first of all, how did you educate yourself on climate change? How did you go about doing that?
I've been reading this literature for 30 or 40 years.
Okay, so you've been interested in the subject ever since the 70s.
Reading Limits to Growth in the very first instance, I've always kept an eye on the physics of the biosphere. So I've had an awareness of the research being done and how serious it was. And then, of course, because I'm now going to start writing on the economics of it, but bringing in the role of energy, because I can now do equations about production where energy is necessarily involved. And with energy necessarily involved, you necessarily have waste because of the second law of thermodynamics. And so I can tie economics and ecology in at the foundational level. And that's what I'm working on as a positive agenda right now. But I also remembered Nordhaus, went back and saw this measurement with our data, evisceration of Limits to Growth, where he clearly didn't understand the technology he was dealing with. And then I started reading his material. And because I thought if I'm going to make comments on climate change from my perspective, then I have to understand the orthodoxy as well. And what I expected was that even I can be naive on neoclassical economics, which is ridiculous because I'm probably the most cynical person about neoclassical economics on the planet. But I still had higher expectations of them than I actually found, because what I thought was they would have taken the damage estimates that were being made by physicists and meteorologists about what's going to happen with climate change, and then they were discounting those because they're far in the future and saying it's trivial now, why worry about it? They do that as well, but in fact they haven't used the damage estimates of physicists and scientists. They've made their own ones up. And the way they've made them up is about three methods they've used. One is what they call the statistical method, and that on the surface sounds reasonable. Let's use statistics. What they've done is assume that the weak relationship we can find today between income of a particular region and the temperature of that region can be used to predict what's going to happen with climate change. So they literally take, for example, the gross state product data for America, output per capita in Nevada, output per capita in Florida, output per capita in New York. Take that data. Take the data as well on temperature, do a scatter diagram, do a fit to it, and they say that fit will tell you what's going to happen when temperature rises 10 degrees.
So what's the reasoning behind that? I'm not sure I follow.
Can I swear on your podcast?
No.
Okay. It is sheer, unbelievable, ignorant stupidity. It is because neoclassical economists...
I love how you use stupidity in place of whatever it is that it was in your head originally.
Oh, mate, I mean, when I first read this material, the line, it comes...
Were you at the OECD giving a presentation?
Yeah.
And on it was this. Was he there?
Richard Toll? No, he wasn't. Okay. Nor Nordhaus. Yeah. They wouldn't have enjoyed it.
Someone was sitting next to you and laughing, though, when you brought up some... You gave an example of what would happen in their model if temperature dropped by like...
4 degrees.
4 degrees.
Yeah, yeah.
And that GDP would drop by like 2% or something?
I think it was 3.6% fall in GDP if temperature fell by 4 degrees.
But you also showed a map of like half of North America would have been frozen.
Yeah, and because what they have done, it's something which neoclassical economists do all the time. They think they need a simplifying assumption. And what they call a simplifying assumption, any sane person would call a fantasy. And that's what they did in this particular case. So they said, we don't have any data on what's going to happen to income as temperature rises. So let's assume that the relationship we see between temperature and GDP today can be used as a proxy of what's going to happen to GDP as temperature rises over time. And the way that's stated in the paper I first read it was by Richard Toll, I think economic.
Why do I know that name?
He's a troll. He's a troll. You'll find him on Twitter all the time.
His last name is not Troll, though. It's Toll.
It's damn close. And he'd be more honest
if it was
Troll.
Why do I know
Troll.
That name, though?
He's fairly prominent.
Richard Toll.
He actually writes the IPCC reports.
Maybe I'm thinking of Richard Vague.
Very different human
Very
being.
Very different human being.
You have
like
to
Richard.
Have Richard on your show. He's brilliant. Toll is a troll. But anyway, in this article, which was used as the basis for the inverted commas data that Nordhaus fitted what he calls his damage function to, which shows the relationship between his predicted relationship between increase in temperature and change in GDP. Toll's paper from 2009 was the basis of that. So I'm reading this paper, and there are various points in the paper where he hedges quite sensibly about how reliable what's being done by economists is. But at one point he says that a particular study by a guy called Mendelsohn assumes that the temperature and GDP relationships we see across space will apply across time as well. Something to that effect.
I don't understand that. I think I saw
Neither does he.
I saw that in your presentation.
I'm actually grab it and quote it because I've got it in my machine. Do you want the quote?
Sure.
Okay. So Richard Toll wrote a survey paper of the work that economists had done to try to predict the damages from climate change. It's called The Economic Effects of Climate Change, published in the Journal of Economic Perspectives in 2009. And I'll now find the quote where he points out how they developed the data. One type of set of data that is used to calibrate the economists' estimates of the damage from climate change. Okay. Mendelsohn's work can be called the statistical approach. It is based on direct estimates of the welfare impacts using observed variations, brackets, across space within a single country, close brackets, in prices and expenditures to discern the effects of climate. Mendelsohn assumes that the observed variation of economic activity with climate over space holds over time as well, and uses climate models to estimate the future effect of climate change.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. I still don't really understand what that means.
Okay, what it means is, how important do you think is temperature in determining the income of New York versus the income of Florida?
It's important. I don't know how important
it is. No, it's trivial.
I mean, okay.
It's the technology that's in New York.
But that can't be true. Well, in other words, what I'm saying is...
Temperature plays a minor role, okay?
But temperature plays an important role in determining what type of economy is born out of that region, right? Like, you don't have a tropical vacation economy in New York.
No, but you couldn't use climate to rule out Singapore.
To rule out Singapore.
Yeah, as a wealthy country, okay? It's got a really hot climate. It's got a wealthy country.
Yeah, but I'm not saying that, but like, I mean, you know, there are important differences. Anyway, I mean, I think there are important differences.
Yeah, but it
depends on how you're
It plays a role, because if you actually plot the data, and I've done this to my own little fit, you can find a rough relationship. A very, very trivial relationship between temperature and GDP.
Well, aren't hotter areas like...
Yeah, generally
not
lower
as
income.
Wealthy.
Yeah. And really cold ones are not as wealthy as well, okay? But what you get out of that is a weak relationship because there are many other factors that are more important. Culture being one.
Sure.
Lee Kuan Yew and Singapore being another, okay? Factors that are more important than the temperature itself overall. And secondly, it's a mild relationship. It's... not the case that if you move to a place that's 10 degrees warmer, the economy will disappear completely.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It'll be less than now, but it won't be completely obliterated. Okay.
So your argument is not, or the point you're making isn't that temperature doesn't play an important role in the type of economy. It's just that it doesn't play an important role in the extent of income.
I'm saying that it can't tell you what's going to happen if you increase or decrease the entire global temperature that much.
Okay.
Because what's happening with global warming fundamentally is we're blanketing, using, chemically blanketing, if you like, the sun, so that some of the Earth, the energy which is normally reflected off the Earth, gets trapped for a longer period and therefore warms the overall planet. So there's an increase
in the lower atmosphere.
Yeah, there's an increase in the energy in the biosphere overall, okay? And that energy increase is why we're talking about a temperature increase. Now, the energy increase, the amount of extra energy retaining from the sun is gigantic. I mean, when I did an estimate at one stage of how many atom bombs we'd need to explode to make similar increase in energy for 1.5 degrees Celsius. I mean, you're talking thousands of Hiroshima bombs a day type level of increase in energy in the biosphere, given the amount of extra energy we're retaining from the sun. So it's a huge change in the energy in the system. Now, when you're saying, let's compare the GDP of gross state product of Dakota to New York to Miami. That's all with a constant level of energy in the biosphere. Now, the important question is, what happens when you change the amount of energy in the biosphere? So that relationship exists, but it's not going to tell you anything about increasing energy on the overall planet, which is why I use the example of global cooling rather than global warming, because the relationship they've fitted to this current GDP and temperature data is simply a parabola, y equals x squared, okay? The x there being the difference between current temperatures and the temperature before industrialization began. So if you're talking a temperature 4 degrees higher than pre-industrial, they're going to say it's 16 times a coefficient. Well, the coefficient tells you how much damage does that do to your GDP. Now, the coefficient Nordhaus is now using is 0.00227 times the temperature difference squared over pre-industrial. That's less than 0.25%, okay? 0.0025 is 0.25. He's using 0.00227. So what he's saying, a 1 degree increase in temperature over pre-industrial will reduce GDP by less than 0.25%. Okay. A 2 degree, maybe 2 squared, which is 4, by less than 1.
So you're saying he won the Nobel Prize for this?
He won the Nobel Prize for it. And if you take a look at his Nobel Prize lecture, you'll see he has a graph showing various temperature trajectories depending on whether we do or don't try
to. So what does he get for a 10 degree rise?
Huh?
What does it give for a 10
degree rise? About a 23% fall in GDP.
A 10 degree rise would be catastrophic for the planet.
Life would cease.
That means, first of all, at 10 degrees, all the ice caps melt, right?
Oh, well, they're gone at probably about 5, but yeah, right. Yeah.
There'd just be no clear, ice. We're not having a conversation here about whether or not the Earth is warming. We're having a conversation here about
if temperatures rose by 10 degrees.
Yeah.
The only ice you'd be left would be on the cap of Mount Everest.
And the, yeah.
So you'd be talking 70, 80 meter sea rise, okay?
Is that how much it would be really?
Something of that order, 70 to 80 meters of extra ocean.
Wow.
And the life, I mean, you've heard what's called the wet bulb temperature measure?
No, what's that?
Okay. You use the thermometer to measure temperature, obviously, the mercury thermometer. If you wrap that in a wet cloth, then the evaporation of the cloth.
Oh, is this the water vapor in the atmosphere?
Water vapor. It's saying if you completely.
It's a feedback loop.
Well, not so much a feedback loop, but the evaporation. If you, like, say it's 50 degrees outside and you put a sock around something, then the evaporation will cool as much as the heat rises. So it turns out that if you measure 35 degrees on a wet bulb thermometer, that is a temperature level at which our cooling systems, humans' cooling systems, break down. So we can no longer sweat to drive our body temperature down below the exterior temperature, and we will die within 6 hours at that temperature. Now, if you had a 10-degree increase in temperature, that would mean that most of the tropics and a fair bit of the subtropics would be uninhabitable. Hmm. Now, so these enormous changes are being trivialized. What Troll will say is that he has a cutoff point. He doesn't imagine it's going to go that high, so it's only going to 4 or 6 degrees. But he literally does talk about 6 degree temperature increase and 4 degrees. This is Nordhaus, talks about a 4 degree temperature increase as optimal.
Optimal literally. Based on the cost that it would take to, intervene and reduce emissions.
And that chart in his 2018 Nobel Prize lecture, which you can find online, he has one chart showing this set of trajectories, and without any mitigation at all, that trajectory shows temperature being 6 degrees above pre-industrial by about 2160, 2170. His optimal eventually stabilizes at 4 degrees above pre-industrial in about 2140. And he calls it optimal because when he does the costs of climate change versus the cost of mitigation, the smallest sum of the two is with a 4 degree increase.
I feel like the conversations about what to do miss the point that the point of friction isn't the dollar amount.
Mm.
And let's actually move beyond simply talking about climate and talk about the environment more broadly, because I think you and I will both agree that the environment's important and conserving the environment is something that we should aim to do, you know?
Mm.
It's sort of organically already happening with plastics, with straws and things like this. But this thing about the money and how much it would cost, I don't think that's the point of friction. The point of friction is the political inertia, right? How are we supposed to do something about the environment in a world where we require international cooperation and we're at a time where international cooperation is moving in the other direction?
Yeah, well, I think we're going to be forced into it. The climate doesn't give a shit about our politics, okay? It doesn't give a shit about our paralysis either. So whatever we do or fail to do, ultimately the consequences of climate change will strike us, and then we'll make the reactions in that political environment. And I think that political environment is going to be so severe, so extreme, that what we call capitalism will no longer survive.
So I should also mention to listeners, two great episodes to listen to that are related to our conversation today are with Brian Arthur on complexity science and complexity economics. And the other one is with Jeffrey West on what are
scale.
Effectively the limits scale.
Yeah, scale, brilliant book.
The limits, exactly. There are physical limits to growth, and that socioeconomic limits are not the same as physical limits.
Yeah, yeah.
And those two systems don't really work very well together at the limit. So to go back to what I was saying, some of the things I've seen related to what the effects of climate change or the projections of what climate change, the effects of that are going to be, the most damaging are not the climate related directly. They're population related, right? Because if you do have flooding in all those low-lying areas in Southeast Asia,
then people have got to move or drown. Yeah. And like some latest studies have found, we're actually been overestimating the height of some of those regions, not underestimating the amount of water that's going to be produced, but overestimating how tall they already are. And it looks like most of Vietnam and a fair bit of Bangladesh will be underwater in the next 20 or 30 years. It's ridiculous how close that
could
be.
So what does that mean for the world? Let's just follow one particular outcome. Let's assume that we do see rising temperature levels and that we just continue on the path that we're on right now, sort of the path of least resistance. Give me a scenario that you've come up with in your head about what the world could look like 10, 20, 30, 50 years into the future.
Well, the transition will involve some parts of the world being forcibly evacuated, which means, of course, massive refugee flows, which means refugees flows into countries that they're not wanted in, which means political conflict. And I think, to me, the most volatile area is going to be around Bangladesh and India. And of course, Bangladesh, so far as we know, doesn't have nuclear weapons, but Pakistan does. And the potential is there for political and nuclear conflict between those countries. We have collapse in food systems will happen, because the analogy that I make to climate change is like putting the lid on a pot that's on the stove already. And the temperature, of course, is going to rise because of that, which means that the circulating cells in there, which they're called Bernard cells, they're going to change location. Where the water goes up and where the water goes down will change because of putting the lid on the pot. The same thing with increasing the temperature. Those up and downs are what give us the large-scale climatic effects that give us rain in the wheat belt and things like that. If they move, and they're moving quite rapidly already, if they break down as well, so for example, the what are called the polar vortex and the Antarctic vortex, if they break down, then those regions which are freezing now will suddenly become affected by the overall circulation of the rest of the planet, meaning the climate change is radically there as well. So the food systems we rely upon will break down. We can't necessarily move to areas where the rain will occur, because you need topsoil to grow, and topsoil does not grow in a matter of centuries.
Also, you need sunlight. The areas that have the most sunlight are in areas now that are warm enough but not too cold. In other words, if you had all the ice melt in Canada, even if you had all the topsoil in the world, you will only have so many days of sunlight.
Yeah, that's
true.
There's
only certain types of crops that will grow in those areas.
That's a good point. I hadn't actually thought of that one beforehand, but you're right. So those sorts of things mean you can't just simply shift the physical location of growing wheat from somewhere in Iowa to somewhere in Alberta.
Is that one of the reasons that some people are investing early stage in some of these Soylent or Impossible Burger style companies? It isn't just a cultural fad, but in fact, there's a push to try and find alternative sources of food. I've seen similar stuff with cricket protein.
Yeah, I can imagine that's happening. I mean, if you're a technologist, you know, I'm unfortunately an economist by training, but if you're a technologist and you're seeing this as a possibility, then you're going to be researching that as a potential profit opportunity, or let alone survival opportunity in future. But yeah, all this stuff means a breakdown of the structure of the climate that currently sustains our civilization. And when scientists have looked at this, their estimates are that if we had a 4-degree increase in temperature, we might be able to sustain a billion people. Now, Nordhaus is calling 4-degree increase in temperature optimal, and his model has no link between population growth and climate. Population just simply assumed to grow to the estimates of the United Nations of the peak carrying capacity of the planet, which I think is 10.5 billion people. So his model assumes we're going to have 10.5 billion people with a 4-degree increase in temperature, and GDP will be about 3.6% lower than it would have been in the complete absence of climate change.
How reliable are these estimates either way? The carrying capacity of the planet. Who the hell knows what the carrying capacity of the planet is? You can make extremely rough estimates.
Well, that's the trouble. So we are trying to predict what's going to happen in circumstances that the planet itself potentially has never experienced. But that's why I like one thing we were talking about earlier, looking at global cooling. Because the damage function the economists are using, particularly Nordhaus, is simply y equals x squared. So you can have x being minus 4 rather than plus 4. And therefore, he's going to say that the damage of a 4-degree fall in temperature would be about a 3.6% fall in GDP. Now, that's what I did in the OECD, showing those old maps. And of course, they're based on the knowledge we actually have of where the ice sheets got to. And at 4 degrees temperature below pre-industrial levels, New York was below about 0.5 kilometer of ice. Chicago was below 1 kilometer of ice. The whole of Canada was gone. And his prediction is that would cause a 3.6% fall in GDP. I'm sorry. That is just ridiculous. You cannot make that sort of extrapolation.
You know, I think putting aside all of these models and predictions and climate change and everything else, we do have a really screwy growth model.
Oh, totally.
Like this, I was walking to the studio today because I was thinking about this, and I was just looking at all the people just passing me by, and we generate so much waste, the fashion industry, all the clothing. We're a consumption-driven economy, and when I say we, I mean the globe, but there's only a small percentage of the planet that actually drives that consumption beltway.
Yep.
And I think we do it because the models we use don't price the externalities. The things that are most valuable, that are worth the most, the quality of the air, the water, the climate, everything, and also things that are far out in the future. If you have children, even if you don't have children, you care about humanity, you should care about, let's say, at the very least, your theoretical grandchildren.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So like, none of that's priced in.
Yeah.
And because it's not priced in, the economy doesn't see it, so it doesn't value it. And so what do? We make trade-offs that we wouldn't normally make if they had a price attached to them.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's like a major shortcoming of our system. And whenever you challenge that, when I say you, I don't mean you specifically, though I'm sure this happens to you. Whenever you challenge that, people immediately have a reaction. Not people, not everyone, but a lot of people think that you're attacking capitalism.
Yeah, yeah.
And that by attacking capitalism, you're somehow suggesting that we should create some alternative system that is socialistic or whatever. And I don't even know if people think that hard about it. I think it's just defensive. People are knee-jerk defensive about it.
It's a visceral reaction which thinks you're attacking a social system that has clearly given enormous benefit to humanity over time. But what you're saying is this would be a great social system if the Earth was the scale of Jupiter. If we could continue.
If there were Newfoundlands. Americas.
Yeah, Newfoundlands. If that was all existed, there was tons of this space, we'd be fine. And in fact, a very conventional economist, William Baumol, wrote a very nice article about this decades ago called what he called Spaceship Earth. And he said, we have in economics, we have a cowboy economics with this vast prairie.
That's fascinating.
Okay. And he said, we live in a crowded economy.
Oh, wow.
Okay. What's sustainable in one is not sustainable in the other.
Totally.
So that in that point, you have to say, if we get to the crowded point, then we can't have unbridled capitalism or unbridled anything. A socialist system would be just as bad. If you see what the Russians did to Lake, I've forgotten the name of the lake, but it's the deepest lake in the world. It's one of the many lakes that was polluted by the Soviets as well. So it is just unbridled growth which is the problem. And therefore you say, how do you control growth when you have a disaggregated system? It becomes something which you can't do just on the basis of individual behavior.
Well, I mean, the Aboriginal lands of Australia, the Americas, these were a very fortuitous bounty that the Europeans came upon. You know, where would the Europeans be if they hadn't discovered the rest of the world?
Yeah.
How long would they have been able to run that model?
Well, they, I mean, would run it more slowly in many ways. I mean, slavery, when I look at what slavery is a way of finding cheap, directable energy. You tell the slave to go and move something, the food the slave is meant to move, the slave can make that effort. So the slave economy was a major factor in pre-Civil War America. It was a major factor in Britain until Britain abolished slavery. So they all harness this source of controllable energy for a long time. And then we discover coal. And not just discover coal, we realize you can use coal in steam engines, and then we don't need the animal power anymore. We've got the power of the coal. We don't realize we're burning an accumulated mass of previous organic matter into the atmosphere, which is where we start overloading with the carbon dioxide. And now we're in the situation where if we'd stopped doing this or started slowing down doing this 50 years ago, roughly when the limits to growth came out, we could still be within the bounds of the cowboy economy. There was a scenario in the limits to growth. I think there were seven scenarios they played. And with one of them, where we had population control, where we had increased efforts on moving across to green energy, more work on pollution sinks, and a range of other changes. Those policies together, the model said we could continue indefinitely. But we didn't. And what we've done is we've more than doubled population since that came out. We've more than doubled per capita energy use. So we've more than quadrupled the load we're putting on the biosphere. And that's where the breakdowns we're seeing are coming from.
Weren't we like 2 million people on the planet back in the 70s?
About three billion. So we're about 7.5 billion now.
You know, this is a really tough thing because most people, what matters to them first is themselves, their family, and their friends, right?
Yep. Mm.
That's true for me. I don't know if it's true for
you.
Yeah. And I don't trust our government or any other government, to be quite honest with you. Maybe the Norwegian government. I don't know the Norwegian government. Maybe there are governments out there that I could theoretically trust if I knew something about them. But I don't trust them enough to put all my eggs in that basket, right? What I think about is how can I protect myself and my family? I feel like that's what most people think, right?
And the trouble is your basket is affected by everybody else's
basket. Yeah, exactly. And the argument would be
yourself.
You can't, exactly. And the argument
no man
would be
is
you
an island.
Exactly, exactly. And there's also the other issue, which is that the people that are most in favor of climate change are, of course, people that are already rich, right?
Yep.
People that, let's say, are trying to generate income. So what I'm trying to say is that this requires a very strong socialist response.
Yes, it does.
Yes, it does. I mean,
socialist in the sense that we do it collectively.
Absolutely. And it requires redistribution of capital. It requires huge collective effort. I mean, you're talking about something analogous to the buildup for World War II.
It is exactly that. That's my normal analogy is World War
II. So people
on steroids.
So that, again, America, think of the sort of cultural economic model. This is a pioneer country.
Yeah.
Right? It's very much about empowerment of the individual. The individual goes out. Let's leave aside the fact that that is a very sort of simplified model of reality, but also it's become much more difficult because of the lopsided wealth distribution, the regulatory capture, all the, you know, we saw those ridiculous bailouts after 2008. But still, what it would require is all sorts of, let's say, people in the country to reorient dramatically the way that they think about or the way that they even go about engaging in the world. It's such a dramatic rethinking.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And on top of that, you need international cooperation. So I just don't see it happening.
Neither do I.
You know what I'm saying?
Neither do I.
So then the question is,
what are the consequences?
So you and I have talked a little bit about this, an eco-fascist model, where a kind of eco-fascism would arise out of this environment from a minimal friction sort of pathway. What are your thoughts on that?
Quite scary, because I think, first of all, I agree that we will not make the political decisions necessary to reverse direction until it's obvious we should have reversed direction 20 or 30 years earlier. But like, that's my Titanic model. You know, you see the iceberg, but you see it too late to change direction you're going to hit. So the question is, when you hit, what the hell's going to happen? And in that world, one of the decisions people will make is there are too many of us.
This is basically the Treaty of Rome a little bit. Not exactly, but there were some, this is either I'm referencing a conspiracy theory or there was something in the Treaty of Rome. Not the Treaty of Rome, sorry.
The
not
Club
the Treaty
of Rome.
The Club of Rome, not the Treaty of Rome. Yeah. The Club of Rome.
The Club of Rome included we had population control.
Right, then, Club of Rome. When the Treaty of Rome was the European Union.
When they did the seven scenarios, the only scenario that actually managed to mean a sustainable load on the biosphere over time included population control. So like, I'm not saying population is the problem. It's the sole problem, but it is.
But it would be a problem at a higher temperature.
Yeah, it's a problem now. We've gone beyond the carrying capacity of the planet. However you estimate it, We
don't really know that, though.
We don't know it. We
might feel it. It certainly feels that way in New York.
Yeah. Well, there's what's called the human ecological footprint, which is an attempt to work out how much of the sustainable reproduction capability of the planet are we absorbing as a species. Now, it does include, I know there are plenty of climate skeptics will be listening to this, hello, but so it does include the carbon dioxide load as part of that measure of, they call the human ecological footprint. But even if you take that out, and so you don't talk about the carbon dioxide load as part of the pressure we're putting on the planet, they are saying we are using about 80% of the complete renewable resources of the planet every year for our species alone. When you include the carbon footprint, it's 1.6 times.
So, Steve, I'm going to move us to the overtime. For regular listeners, you know the drill. If you're new to the show or you haven't subscribed yet, head over to patreon.com/hiddenforces or go into the description to this week's episode. I have a link where you can sign up to our audiophile subscription and get access to this week's overtime, or to the autodidact or super nerd tiers, which give you access to the transcripts and rundowns. This week, there is no rundown because Steve called me a few days ago or emailed me a few days ago to tell me he'd be in town. And this is going to be an additional episode in addition to what we normally put out every week. So there's no rundown. But if you want to hear the overtime or get access to the transcript, again, head over to patreon.com/hiddenforces and join us in our conversation. Today's episode of Hidden Forces was recorded at Creative Media Design Studio in New York City. For more information about this week's episode, or if you want easy access to related programming, visit our website at hiddenforces.io and subscribe to our free email list. If you want access to overtime segments, episode transcripts, and show rundowns full of links and detailed information related to each and every episode, check out our premium subscription available through the Hidden Forces website or through our Patreon page at patreon.com/hiddenforces. Today's episode was produced by me and edited by Stylianos Nikolaou. For more episodes, you can check out our website at hiddenforces.io. Join the conversation at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Hidden Forces Pod, or send me an email at dk@hiddenforces.io. As always, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.